Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
And now, Veep Thoughts by Kamala Harris.
So, there are two pots of water and two frogs. And in one pot, you put the frog in the water and you slowly turn up the heat. And that frog's just hanging out as the heat just slowly gets hotter to the point that that water starts to boil and that frog perishes. In the other pot of water, you first turn up the heat real high. The water's boiling, you drop that frog in, he'll jump right out. The lesson there, as far as I'm concerned, don't be that first frog.
This has been Veep Thoughts by Kamala Harris.
Stu Does America.
Oh, we are close. We are close to this whole thing being over. I can't believe it. Let me start with just giving you a breakdown of the next few days. We have a show for you today that I think you'll enjoy. A lot of really good stuff on it. Stanley Kurtz is here to talk about Tim Walz's education appointee, who apparently wants to overthrow the United States government. That's going to be a lot of fun. Andrew Cuomo keeps flirting with being held accountable for his actions during COVID. I'm sure it won't happen, but I'll give you the latest on legal issues anyway. We're going to start by doing Kamala's last-ditch lies, though. Before we get into all of that, I want to tell you that this is our last show of the week. On Monday, we will be back with another show, and that's kind of the big one, right? The big pre-election show. Tomorrow, we'll probably have a state of the race for you on podcast only, so you'll have some, deep dive into the election and the process behind it. That's available audio only on the Studios America audio stream. So just go to wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to Studios America. That will just pop up in your feed tomorrow. But on Monday, we'll do the big chalkboard show, the final chalkboard show before the election. Now, you may know, if you were a long-time viewer of this program, 4 years ago in 2020, we did an election chalkboard. That one we got exactly right on the electoral count, 306 to 232. I will tell you, I'm not nearly as confident this year as I was 4 years ago. But we do this before every election to try to give you a final thought. And a lot of times you get states that are in the middle. You're like, oh, gosh, this is a real toss up. I don't know. I'm just going to, take a guess and, my best guess for you and put it in one of the categories. And we will give you a final electoral count the day before the election. It's a show that people look forward to. We'll give you the Senate race and Senate races and, of course, the Electoral College. And we'll do our best to kind of preview what's going to happen the next night. God only knows in this particular environment whether we'll be right, but we'll do our best. Then on election night itself, we will be preempted because of the Blaze TV's election night coverage. I'll be a part of that, of course. I'll be the one calling the states and letting you know where we are as we go through. And that will be the big night, Tuesday, the election show goes on. I think it's blazeelection.com/Stu. You can subscribe there. We'll start at 6 p.m. Eastern, I believe it is, right? 6 p.m. Eastern. And we will go all the way till, I don't know, we can't talk anymore, probably midnight or 1 a.m. or 2 a.m., something like that. So we'll just be on for a very, very long time. Colin states, hopefully we get a result, but God only knows at this point. And then after that, I'll be on YouTube, youtube.com/Stu Does America, doing the late after show that we would love you to join as well. You can hear my voice. Oh, I'm already losing it. I did Megyn Kelly's show earlier today. I did the radio show. This is the time of year. People are like, oh, gosh, this must be the nightmare time of year for you. No, it's the nightmare time of every 4 years. This is the worst possible period. I'm going to do my best to get you through it. And I will tell you on the Tuesday show in the early morning, we'll reveal this on radio. We will also give you a final update of our PulseCast model, where we look at all the available data, election models, prediction markets, and polling averages, and give you like the percentage chance that the data is telling you Donald Trump will have to win and Kamala Harris have to win. So tons and tons of stuff If you're not already following the YouTube page, please go over there. Now is a great time to do it. YouTube.com/StuDoesAmerica. If you click the bell for notifications, you'll also get when we go. You'll get the moments where we go live. And we're going to do that for sure after the election coverage. Probably we'll do some sort of live before the election coverage as well, previewing what's coming up that night. And then we'll also have some other lives between now and then. Okay, so you've set the stage here. Now let's talk about something that's really pissing me off. We'll start with this. Election officials are outmatched by Elon Musk's misinformation machine. Can you imagine typing that? Can you imagine pitching that as a headline? Can you imagine how insulting that would be to any conservative who came close to your particular site, CNN? Elon Musk, this one website is the thing. They're overwhelming. Election officials are outmatched by Elon Musk's misinformation machine. What do you think you are, CNN? The left wing has every media source, with the exception of Fox News. They have every social media network, with the exception of Twitter/X. And then there's like, you know, The Blaze and like, I don't know, Daily Wire and, you know, National Review and like, I don't know who else, a couple of other places, a couple other websites. They have almost the entire media complex on their side. And because Elon Musk bought one website, they're freaking out. It's absolutely incredible. They run everything and they're complaining about X. Now, if you want to get a sense as to how dramatic this is, look at the coverage. I'll give you one example, the New York Times. This is, as you may know, the paper of record. Let me give you a little taste of what their coverage looked like today. Because you can take any piece of information and you can spin it, right? You can say, oh, hey, this is really bad for Joe Biden / Kamala Harris. Or you can say it's really bad for Donald Trump. Or you could say it's really good for Kamala Harris. Or you could say it's really good for Donald Trump. You make that decision at some level. How are we going to interpret this data? Let me give you a sense as to what the New York Times ran this morning. Inflation is basically back to normal. Why do voters feel blah? Biggest issue in the campaign, inflation. Why are you so stupid? Why do you think it's wrong? Why do you think it's bad? It's actually pretty much normal at this point. Now, of course, what that doesn't include is the fact, of course, that inflation, even when it does get back to relatively normal levels, it's in an increase on the previous increases. Prices are still going up. They're not coming down. They're still going up. They're going up at the normal rate after they've gone up at a really high rate for multiple years. So, yeah, people are still going to be. That's why, by the way, they're blah. Next up. How public health could be recast in a second Trump term. You'll be surprised to know it's not going to be recast well. They think it's going to suck. Shocking, I know. How about this? Why the right thinks Trump is running away with a race. Skewed polls and anonymous betting markets are building up Republican expectations. Donald Trump could use that to challenge the result. The point of this article was to say, first of all, none of it's real. The polls are just Republican outfits running right-wing polls that are showing them out, Republicans out ahead. The betting markets are just, you know, conservative billionaires somewhere in France manipulating these markets. Now, there is some possibility of truth in that one, though the amount of money it would take to move these markets is incomprehensible. We're talking nine figures. Now, if you want to waste nine figures to slightly improve the news cycle for Donald Trump, I guess you can do it. But man, it's really a big waste of money, frankly. And also, you'd have to do it over several different markets. They're all moving in the similar patterns, which is kind of interesting. In addition to that, they're saying the whole reason why people like Elon Musk or this French billionaire or whoever else are manipulating these markets and running all these Republican polls is that afterward, when Trump loses, Republicans can claim they actually won. What are you talking about? The prediction markets showed that we were going to win. Now, the prediction markets don't necessarily predict the future with any sort of internal data. What they do give you is a really good glimpse as to how people interpret the available situation. They give you a perfect representation of how people actually view the race. And right now, people view the race as if Donald Trump's going to win. That doesn't mean they're right. They might be. We'll see. I'll give you a pulse cast update right now, see how close they are. Now, then you have the next issue in the New York Times is covering how the U.S. election matters for the rest of the world. The example? South Africa. Trump resembles a lot of autocratic African leaders, is the quote from someone in South Africa. Fair and balanced, boys and girls. Then you get this one. Late abortions rarely happen, but they still dominate politics.
All right, let's start with a headline.
In what freaking world do late-term abortions dominate politics? It is almost impossible to find an example of a politician being held, having their feet to the fire on the left by an actual journalist about late-term abortions. Give me a date when it's okay. Okay? The only thing you're ever going to find is probably Shannon Bream, who actually has followed up with Tim Walz on this question. Outside of that, it's almost never asked. In fact, much more commonly do you get really fringe situations on the other side that are asked. Here's a little child who wanted an abortion because she was raped by a relative. A truly horrific situation, but a really, really rare one, and almost impossibly rare. Republicans are constantly held to account to answer for every impossibly rare situation that could possibly go on for someone who wants an abortion. Every single one of them gets dredged up in the media. We'll give you an example here in just a moment about an example of why Republican restrictive policies exist. And of course, they also never hold Democrats' feet to the fire on this at all. They never have to answer this very important question that, you know, maybe can a late-term abortion even occur in our society? Let me give you this example from this article in the New York Times. Republicans and groups that oppose abortion rights argue that Democrats are pushing abortions for any reason in the 7th, 8th, and 9th month of pregnancy, even after birth. John Tester supports aborting a healthy, full-term baby the day before it's due. Tim Sheehy, the Republican challenger for Senate in Montana, says falsely on his campaign website. Donald Trump went further into inaccuracies, saying Democrats would allow women to execute the baby. Now, look at that word, falsely. There it is. Just highlighted for your enjoyment. It's underlined in blue on there, but it's also circled in red in one of the graphics that we have. Maybe that one's not available. But the point is, it goes to a particular article in PolitiFact that shows that this is false. Sheehy's claim is false. And you think to yourself, okay, well, how is it false? How is it false? I'm curious how it's false, because I happen to know that it's not false. Okay. In a televised debate, June 8th, Sheehy accused Tester and Democrats of voting for elective abortions up to and including the moment of birth. That statement prompted Tester to respond, "To say we're killing babies at 40 weeks is total BS." Now, if you happen to be intellectually curious at all, you might notice that the answer to say that we're killing babies at 40 weeks is total BS does not answer the question as to whether you're for it or against it. It doesn't answer the question as to whether you oppose it or you support it. It just says it's not happening. We'll get into that in a couple of minutes, because that one's covered in the New York Times article. But to continue, Tester in Montana was on the wrong side, in my view, of multiple bills that would prove that he supports this. The bill explicitly would allow, after a fetus is viable, according to the legislation, in the good faith medical judgment of the treating health care provider, a continuation of the pregnancy would pose a risk to the patient's life or health. Now, we know, if anyone who's familiar with the abortion rate debate knows that the reason why they use that particular carve-out is because if you get one liberal doctor that says, actually, this would be bad for the health, oftentimes including the mental health of the woman, her mental health would be affected if this baby was born, that's the standard, then you can abort the baby. In other words, any liberal doctor who wants to give you the abortion could just say it affects your health and give it to you. In fact, abortionists who have gone to the Supreme Court have argued, well, they could theoretically die during childbirth, so therefore they're avoiding that death with the abortion, and it's good for their health. Just that is enough to hit this standard, which is ridiculously low. Besides that, which was the Women's Health Protection Act that Tester was on the wrong side of, the Sheehy campaign cited Tester's opposition to the Born Alive legislation meant to protect babies who survive botched abortion. This is all the bill did. Said, hey, you know what? We should, if a baby's born alive, we should let that happen. This is a bill that passed already back in 2002, before Tester was in Congress. And he opposed the 2022 update that made sure that the loopholes being utilized by the left afterward were closed up. Again, he voted against it. Why? Because, of course, he does support it. And you could say, well, wait a minute. If you ask him, and he says, I don't want abortions to happen at 40 weeks. That's bad. Now, I've never heard him actually say that. He says they don't happen at 40 weeks. But he never says I oppose it. But, you know, that's the kind of the vibe of this New York Times article. They say late-term abortions rarely happen. So much to dig through on this one. What does that mean exactly? First of all, who cares if they rarely happen? I'm glad they more rarely happen than the other types of abortions that end the baby's life, I guess. I don't know. They're both ending lives. But OK, great. The fact that you don't do them as often later on, largely because you did them earlier, right? They can't abort a baby that's already been aborted. So most of the abortions happen earlier. That's true. It's overwhelmingly true, by the way. Very small percentage of abortions happen after even viability, but certainly into the 30th and 40th weeks. But you know what else is really, really rare? School shootings. You wouldn't think that is true while you're looking at the coverage, but school shootings are an incredibly, impossibly small percentage of gun violence overall. They happen incredibly rarely. Very few people lose their lives in these mass school shootings that make all the headlines. A lot of times, you know, people will be like, oh, well, Columbine. Yeah, the reason why you know Columbine and you know a couple of the other names of these school shootings are because they're really rare. They're really standout events. They make you notice because they're impossibly terrible. But you know what? I can tell you right now, real easily, I oppose them. I don't have any problem. I don't have to give you, well, these aren't really happening, and not address whether I oppose them or not. I don't have to say, well, you know, if the school principal and the person who's getting shot agree with the school shooting, then it's okay. I don't need that carve out. Because I oppose school shootings. It's really freaking easy. In fact, I'll go to a further standard on this. I oppose school shootings so much, I want them to be illegal. I can hit that standard really easily on school shootings. Why can no leftist ever get to that place on abortion? Why can't they say, well, I don't support them, of course, in the 7th, 8th, and 9th month. I don't support them on the day before pregnancy. Well, that's interesting. I don't really freaking care whether you support them or not. What is your position on the actual debate? Because the debate is based on whether they're legal or not. And I want this question to be asked to Kamala Harris, to Tim Walz. Let me ask you this. If a woman comes into an abortion clinic in the 9th month of their pregnancy, a few weeks, a couple days, a couple hours before that pregnancy occurs, and they say, you know what? My doctor agrees. My doctor's on board. I'm on board. It's time to abort this thing. What do you say? Should they legally be allowed to do so? That's the question I would like answered. Would you say that should be legal or not? Not whether you support it. I don't care whether you want it personally for your own life. Who freaking cares about your life? I don't care about your life and your opinions about your life at all. What I care about is your position on the legislation. Should it be legal or not? Should the woman, even if everyone in her community, her family, her doctors all line up and say, you know, it would be wonderful if we ended the life of that child in her womb. Even if that's where they are, do you think it should be legal? And if your answer to that is yes, then you support it. I believe murder should be illegal. I don't believe school shootings should be legal under any circumstances, even though they're impossibly rare situations. The debate is about the legal line where this procedure exists. Every politician knows that on the left. You know who else knows it? Every journalist asking them about it. But they never ask it that way because it puts them then in a position where they have to admit what's actually true, which is what Sheehy said and what Trump said, frankly, even though he used a more of a rhetorical flourish. So, and I'll ask you this too, John Tester, if you're against this, forget even the law for a moment. Have you ever spent a minute advocating against nine-month abortions, third-term abortions? Do you ever go out and say, make a big speech on the Senate floor saying, God, I got to stop those? By the way, did I mention you should vote probably against the guy who's for this? That's just my opinion. But John Tester in Montana in a big Senate race, huge race. Who are you going to vote for in that race if you're in Montana? Now, let me ask and add another additional part to this media part of the conversation, which is look at the way they manipulate the language here. The whole thing is about, well, there's only been like two late-term abortions in this state and one in this state. In Colorado, like maybe a couple hundred, but it's not really common. So why are we talking about it? Let me show you how they manipulate the language. Now, this is from The Washington Post in 2019. I'm not taking this from a conservative site. This is The Washington Post, 2019. What is a late-term abortion? Good question in this context. Let me read it to you. What are late-term abortions? Late-term abortions are generally understood to take place during or after the 21st to 24th week of gestation, which is the late in the second trimester. Remember that number. The gestational period roughly corresponds to the point of fetal viability, or when a fetus might be able to survive outside the womb or without medical assistance. However, there is no precise medical or legal definition, of late term, and many doctors and scientists avoid the language, calling it imprecise and misleading. They say late term may apply to these abortions or taking place when a woman has reached or passed a full term pregnancy, which is defined as starting in the 37th week. Okay, got that? Generally understood to be the 21st week, 24th week. But could be as late as the 37th week if you really want to push it, right? That's the definition from 2019, The Washington Post. What is that now? Remember, I told you how rare they were. These things never occur, according to the New York Times today. Well, when you dig into their 9-million-word story, you realize kind of how they get to that standard. Here it is. Most states prohibit abortion after viability, when the fetus can survive outside the uterus. With medical technology, that's now about 24 weeks. But a fetus is at term, meaning it can survive on its own after intervention, is 37 weeks. And late term refers to pregnancies that go beyond the usual 40 weeks, meaning that late term abortions do not happen. Well, when you define late term abortions as happening literally after almost all births occur, yeah, they probably are pretty freaking rare. After 40 weeks is now the standard for late-term abortions? When did that start? Certainly after 2019, we know that, but I don't know. It seems like it started with this freaking article. And yeah, you can of course come up with an article that they're really super duper rare when you start with 40 weeks as your standard. Unfreaking believable. Now, it gets worse than that. Let me give you another example of this. Here's Nicholas Kristof. Here's a story he wants to tell you about how bad these Republican abortion laws are. Roe versus Wade has been overturned. Look at these poor mommies and daddies. Here's Nicholas Kristof. A struggling Nevada mom suffers a miscarriage. Then the police show up and arrest her for manslaughter, and she's sentenced to 2.5 to 8 years at prison. Only when a pro bono lawyer steps up and appeals does a judge reverse the conviction and set her free to return her to her children. This is family values? Think about that as you vote. Now, the community notes do a wonderful job stepping up and pointing out the facts of this. Here's what they note. Number one, the mom smoked meth while pregnant. Number two, her baby was well past viability, between 28 and 32 weeks. Number three, she admitted she smoked the drugs to kill the child. Number four, law enforcement believes the baby was born alive and then killed. And number five, this occurred in 2018 before Roe versus Wade was overturned. But other than that, what's the problem with that flowery reporting? Now, of course, does Kristof pay any attention to the facts of the story? Of course not. I think he read this story. This is from The Washington Post. By the way, remember them in 2019 saying it was 21 to 24 weeks? Now they're on this kick. She said she had a miscarriage, then got arrested under an abortion law. Does that make you think that Republicans are responsible for this? Well, it happened in Nevada, by the way, that doesn't have any of the restrictive laws that we're talking about, and it happened before Roe versus Wade was even overturned. Ah! If you want to go back and read the real reporting, I can give you this. I can't go through all of it, but Nevada woman arrested for a miscarriage. This is from the Nevada Independent. This is an older story. She was pregnant. Sure, she didn't want to be, so she took a pregnancy test in February 2018. It was positive. She didn't know how long she was. She had to go through all the details of periods, which I don't want to talk to you about. But it goes on and on and on. She couldn't find a ride to Reno. At 26, she looked for home remedies for abortion, including having large amounts of cinnamon. Who knew Cinnamon Toast Crunch could abort your child? That didn't work. But she did have lots of drugs, and she lifted heavy objects. She had a stillbirth she intended to cause. She added a few more layers in a mesh bag and after the baby came out and buried it in the backyard. The law means that she wasn't allowed to have the baby after the 24th month. It happened, of course, or 24th week, excuse me. It happened between 28 and 32. They found traces of methamphetamine and marijuana. She got in trouble, and I'm supposed to feel really bad about that. That's the basic story here. But consider this. Consider the bias for a second. I just gave you great examples of how biased the media is, but you probably knew that coming into this monologue now, didn't you? Their standard for this race was that late-term abortions dominate politics. That's, on its face, obviously false, blatantly false in so many ways. What dominates politics when it comes to abortion is health care. Abortions are women's rights. Stop hurting women by counseling them on whether they should stop the lives of the child that they're about to give birth to. What dominates politics are lies. And I think it's quite clear. We've heard that, for example, Tim Walz is this wonderful figure. He's a teacher, you know. He's a teacher and a football coach. And he goes hunting and fishing. That's all you know about him. Well, let me tell you the actual truth about Tim Walz. We'll do that with National Review's Stanley Kurtz next. How much time do you spend thinking about worst case scenarios? If you happen to be Glenn Beck watching the show, the amount of time you spend is all the time. But you got to be prepared for him. I want to be the type of person, honestly, because me and Glenn differ a little bit on this. Glenn has been fired up for years and years and years and years about preparedness. And of course, it's good to be prepared. I'm kind of more of the person who wants to say, gosh, that's smart. I should probably prepare for that. But what I don't want to do is think about it all the time. Now, there is something you can do for you and your loved ones to have medication on hand when it's needed. I never thought of this, honestly, before. I was never like, oh, medication. You know, I get food, I got water. What else do I need? You need medication. If you don't have the medications you need, you could die from basic bacterial infections. We usually have antibiotics for that. Well, if you don't have those around, what goes on? So get the Jace case from Jace Medical. Easy. You knock it out once. You don't have to worry about it for a while. The Jace case is a personalized emergency kit that contains essential antibiotics and medications that treat the most common and deadly bacterial infections. It provides 5 life-saving antibiotics for emergency use. Just fill out a simple form online and you'll have it in case you need it. Go to Jace.com, enter the code STU at checkout, and discount on the order will be yours. It's Jace.com. The code is STU, JASE.com. The code is STU.
Wahnsinn, wie schnell das Jahr wieder vorbeigezogen ist. Fast wie die Elektrofahrzeuge und Plug-in-Hybride von Opel. Und noch was kommt angebraust. Bis zu 5.000 Euro mit der geplanten gesetzlichen Förderprämie für E-Mobilität 2026. So geht klimafreundlicheres Fahren. Lass dich unverbindlich und persönlich beraten. Alle Infos auf opel.de. Die Höhe und Verfügbarkeit der staatlichen Förderungen hängen von den jeweils gültigen Richtlinien ab. Ob und wie sie die Voraussetzungen erfüllen, wird im Einzelfall geprüft.
So when people are running for office, why do we bother looking back at their records? What's the purpose of that? Obviously, you kind of want to know what positions, what policies they might have, but also you want to kind of judge their decision-making process and how those decisions turn out. It's why we do this. It's why we talk about this stuff leading up to an election. With that context, I want to play some audio for you and video. This is an education appointee by Tim Walz. I want you to listen to him discuss his worldview.
We're also sometimes lying on ourselves when people say like, oh, we use critical race theory in school. We don't use critical race theory in school. The first tenet of critical race theory is that the United States as constructed is irreversibly racist. So if the nation state as constructed is irreversibly racist, then it must be done with. It must be overthrown, right? And so we can't be like, oh no, critical race theory is just about telling our stories and diverse. It's not about that. It's about overthrow. It's insurgent. And we need to be, I think, more honest with that.
I would agree with you. You should be more honest about that. I want to bring in Stanley Kurtz. He's the guy who wrote about this, you know, weeks before it even went viral online. He's a senior fellow for the Ethics and Policy Center, as well as contributing editor for National Review. His article is Wall's Education Appointee Calls for the Overthrow of the U.S., which you might think that's a title. That seems a little crazy. No, it's exactly what he just said. You heard it. I'll be sure to tweet out a link to that shortly. Stanley, welcome to the program. Appreciate it.
Stu, thanks for having me.
I really appreciate you writing about this because, and I can't believe it's not a bigger deal so far. I mean, this is a massive story. Can you kind of take us through it? Who is this guy?
Well, this fellow, Brian Lozensky, is a professor at a Minnesota college called McAllister College, and he's an extremely influential education advisor to Governor Walz. And what made him influential is that he really was the central voice in Minnesota arguing that schools ought to teach something called ethnic studies. Now, ethnic studies sounds like a reasonable, innocent subject where you'd say you learn about people going to Ireland and kissing the Blarney Stone. But the truth is that ethnic studies in the version that Brian Lozensky supports, it is extremely radical. It only focuses on Blacks, Latinos, Native Americans, and Asian Americans. And its entire theme is that these groups are oppressed by the United States and rightfully resist the United States. And so Walz has really leapfrogged even Governor Newsom in California, who has, to some degree, adopted this radical version of ethnic studies, but Walz has done it much more intensely. And Lozensky was the main advocate for adding this ethnic studies to the social studies standards in Minnesota. And now he and his followers are running the committee that will, in effect, create the curriculum to put into effect these social studies standards in the state. So he's very influential in Minnesota.
And this isn't something, you know, sometimes you have these controversies where someone unearths some video or tweet or something that's really, really extreme after someone's named to a position, and people act all surprised about these crazy things this person believes. That's not the case here, right? Like, this guy was known for this type of rhetoric, and it seems to be a big part of the reason he was appointed in the first place.
Yes. Lozensky has been saying radical things for years. And for years, conservatives, in particular in Minnesota, have been sounding a warning about Lozensky's radical views. They may not know have known about this very specific call for the overthrow of the United States, but he inched up to that position and got, you know, within just a millimeter of it over the last 2 years. So nothing about this is surprising. Governor Walz has been warned repeatedly by the opposition to this ethnic studies program, and he plowed right ahead and appointed Lozensky and all of Lozensky's followers to run education in the state.
You know, and it's funny, I think you hear someone calling for the overthrow of the government. It almost doesn't even seem real. But what does seem really central to the argument being made by the left right now is another thing he said, which is the United States is irreversibly racist. And, you know, this seems to be honestly right in the core message of the Democratic Party. It relates to calling, you know, American voters garbage. And there is this opinion that anyone who would consider Donald Trump or consider any right-leaning candidate has this sort of like incurable disease of racism that has permeated their entire lives. That worldview is incredibly damaging, isn't it, Stanley?
So, yes, Stu, you're absolutely right. For example, there's a concept that Lozensky has put into Minnesota's social studies standards called racial capitalism. This is a very left-wing concept, and the basic idea is that as long as a society is capitalist, it will inevitably be racist. So there's really nothing you can do to cure racism without overthrowing capitalism. That is literally the message that Lozensky has put into the standards approved by Governor Walz that will now be taught to all the children of Minnesota. So it's just another way of saying all these phrases, institutionally racist, systemically racist. Now we've got this idea of racial capitalism that says without a revolution, society will never stop being racist.
Mm. I think this brings us to Kamala Harris, because Harris has the biggest decision she'll ever make in her life, who she's going to pick as her running mate. And, you know, it comes down seemingly, reportedly, to two people, Tim Walz and Josh Shapiro. Now, a lot of the focus has been on, it seems like a good chunk of the Democratic Party has an affinity for the positions of Hamas, and they might not have enjoyed Josh Shapiro as the pick. But this has to be part of it, too. Shapiro is kind of known as a Democrat who, at least on the somewhat fringes, embraces an idea of school choice, who seems to be somewhat at least moderate, for, particularly for Democrats, on the education issue. And her choice in that moment, her decision-making process, leads her to take a person who appoints someone who wants to overthrow the U.S. government. I mean, that has to be notable. What does this tell us about Kamala Harris?
Well, Stu, I think you're absolutely right. Kamala Harris, of course, is famous for being the most leftist senator as far as her voting record goes. And she said she just felt more comfortable with Walz. Walz is certainly one of the most left-leaning governors. And I can tell you for sure, he's got the most left-leaning education program. And so even without knowing this particular quote, I think Kamala Harris felt comfortable with Walz's leftism in all fields, including education. And my worry is that she will basically give the education portfolio of the White House over to Walz, and that he will give us Common Core 2.0, but this time it will be about history and civics, and it will be infused with this radical ethnic studies that Walz has put into Minnesota.
Stanley, do you have a sense as to what happened with Walz from the time he was a congressman? I mean, he was known as a guy, I mean, the NRA gave him a good rating at one point. He was sort of known as this moderate congressman on the Democratic side. And the second he got into the gubernatorial election victory, he has governed as an extreme leftist. I mean, was that in him the entire time? Did he get convinced by the climate around him? How do you trace that?
I think it was in him all along. I think his affinity for communist China was there. He happened to get into Congress by running in a relatively moderate district. But when he got into the governorship in a relatively blue state, I think he then threw caution to the wind and just became who he really was. And by the way, at the beginning of the campaign, this has been forgotten since the early campaign, but he had that phrase, one man's socialism is another man's neighborliness. Mm. And I put out a piece, admittedly speculative, but I put out a piece that explained that the radical socialist historian Howard Zinn has a whole chapter in which he argues that America ought to adopt a neighborly socialism. This is exactly the turn of phrase from Howard Zinn. And remember, Walz was a social studies teacher. And what progressive social studies teacher has not read Howard Zinn? So that's another sign that tells me, if the speculation is accurate, that Walz has really been a sort of Howard Zinn socialist style Democrat all along.
Well, I mean, all of their ads are talking about how tough they are on the border and all of this. I think when you look just below the surface, it's really, really obvious how they're going to govern if they get into office. And I find it on Halloween quite frightening, Stanley. Stanley Kurtz, be sure to check out the piece. It's a National Review. It's called Walz Education Appointee Calls for the Overthrow of the U.S. You can find a link to it on my Twitter and find the story about Howard Zinn as well. Stanley, I appreciate all your hard work on this. Thanks for digging into it, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
And thanks for having me, Stu.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Ah, it's time for one of our final PulseCast updates. That's right, the PulseCast, which summarizes election models and prediction markets and polling averages, and gives you one little nice little number to kick this out. It's Donald Trump now with a 52.85% chance to win the presidential election. You might note That means this election is close. And here's the thing. I like my data. I like looking at this stuff. I don't take these things as gospel and say, well, that means he has a 52.85% chance of winning. I take them as kind of guidance, trying to understand generalities, which is what polls kind of tell us. And, you know, you go from there and you try to read into other stuff and you make a prediction. We'll do that again on Monday's program. But one thing I will tell you is the data is going to let you down this year. There's no amount of polling that's going to come out between now and the election that's going to make the pulse cast look like, oh, it's a 70% favorite for one or the other. It is, unfortunately, we are in a situation that's going to leave us with big question marks on election night. And that'll make it interesting. So join us, blazeelection.com/stew. Promo code, I don't know what it is, but you'll save like $40. I think it's code is stew. Okay, so check that out. Anyway, the data's there. It tells us a story. The story is quite indecisive. So we will maybe get more later on. By the way, Joe Biden will attend the inauguration in January, regardless of who wins. And wow, that is amazing. That's, of course, what most presidents have done. Now, notably, Donald Trump did not. They, of course, were trying to impeach him and imprison him at the time. So maybe a little understandable. But it is one of those situations. Normally you do this. And, you know, I don't really care what Joe Biden does. I just want to make sure Bernie Sanders shows up. Because if Bernie shows up, he's going to look like this. And that is going to make me happy. With little mittens on, a little mask on, he's sitting by himself. And I just, oh, he's adorable, isn't he? What a weird time that was. I have to think back to the COVID era. Yes. The outdoor mask. Never at any point has that ever, I'm not talking about, well, I didn't believe it because I'm a conservative and I don't like masks. No, at no point has any study ever mentioned that it would be beneficial to wear a mask outdoors when it's cold, when you're alone like that in particular, unless you're talking right up against somebody's face. There's basically no chance of you catching something like that outdoors. I will say, though, in that particular situation for Bernie, probably kept him kind of warm. So that's good. By the way, there's this breaking news from the New York Times. This is going to shock you. You might think, oh, Donald Trump, I want him to be president. He's going to go out there and he's going to do things that I like. And no, that's not the truth. Something much scarier is the truth. From the New York Times, a unified Republican Congress would give Trump broad power for his agenda. Well, yeah, that's how our government operates. You know, if a bunch of Republicans got elected, it would be easier for Donald Trump to pass his Republican proposals. So, yeah, that's, are you just trying to tell me how the system of government works? I mean, I know you don't know, because normally you're cheering on things like the student loan catastrophe, where Joe Biden just does whatever he wants and then gets overturned by the Supreme Court. But you don't really need to give us an article to tell us if Republicans win, more Republican things will happen. Back in a second. It's been a while since I've mentioned Andrew Cuomo is awful.com. It's true. Andrew Cuomo is awful, and maybe he's going to see some consequences. I kind of doubt it. House COVID panel refers Andrew Cuomo for potential prosecution. He was accused of engaging in a conscious, calculated effort to avoid accountability for his handling of nursing homes where thousands of people died of COVID, according to the referral from the Republican-led House Select Subcommittee on Coronavirus Pandemic. Referral comes at a pivotal moment for Cuomo, who's trying to become mayor of New York. Which you should, you know, I mean, should not happen. He's obviously terrible in every single way. Cuomo's handling of the pandemic after a nice little wonderful joy. It's like the joy period for Kamala. It was like a happy period where he was like Mr., you know, press conference guy, kind of fell apart. He was ordered to return $5 million on his from his memoir. They ruled that he had used state resources to write it. Several state and federal entities, including the Justice Department, have looked into the March 2020 guidance from the New York State Department of Health. None of the inquiries resulted in criminal action, but the state health department report issued on July 6, 2020 was an early effort to beat back blame, basically. And, you know, he went on and on and on to try to hide it. So I don't know. Will he get any penalties? Probably not. Honestly, I don't think much is going to come of this. He'll probably become mayor of New York City, which is kind of what New York deserves. So there you go. By the way, I hope he gets a fine like this. Russia has fined Google 20 undecillion rubles. That's two followed by 36 zeros. Because they refuse to pay fines that are now accruing for blocking pro-Russian channels on YouTube. Seems a bit excessive, but it's the the amount is so high, it counts to $20 decillion, or about $20 billion trillion. So it's kind of a big number. But, you know, hey, you can do it in installments, probably. Back in a second. We did a lot today on how bad the media is and how it doesn't cover important stories. That's why the Blaze exists. BlazeElection.com/stew. You can join us and help with our mission to actually give you news coverage that matters and is valuable to you and is actually true. BlazeElection.com/stew. Right now, you get $40 off if you go there, and you'll be part of our election night coverage. That is going from 6 p.m. Eastern until we can't talk anymore, basically. So join us there, and then join us on YouTube.com/stewdoesamerica afterward. It's going to be a long couple of days.